Welcome to the Brave Feminine Leadership podcast, where I get to dig into delicious conversations with global leaders and we get to hear all about their perspective on life and leadership. And today I am so thrilled to have Lisa Martello with me. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. Let me touch on your bio so the audience get to understand who I'm talking to, and then we'll get going with our conversation. So Lisa's a senior infrastructure delivery leader with over 15 years of experience working on major rail and construction projects in the UK and Australia. She moved to Australia a few years ago to take on a role as a package director on the Melbourne Airport Rail project. That'll get a few people fired up already, Lisa. Lisa is passionate about inclusive leadership, workplace culture and diversity, and advocates for an everyday focus on the little actions and behaviours that have a big impact on our ability to attract, but more importantly, retain women and other minorities in the workplace. As the founder and content creator of Daily Workplace Catharsis in Instagram and LinkedIn account Catching Bees, Lisa has been called a truth monster, a professional mirror holder upperer, and a shit stirrer. They are just great descriptions, and I resemble each of them. She's trying to create a social movement for women and minorities to expect more and demand better. Lisa, I'm so thrilled to have you here. We'll touch on later what drew me to you, how I first kind of came in touch with you, but excited to share your story. So before I go any further, let's hand the microphone over to you. And can you share with us, who are you as a human being? Tell us your story.
So, big question. I suppose work-wise, I would describe myself as a project manager by trade, and I've always been in the railway industry. Got into that when I was 22 and joined the Transport for London graduate scheme, and the rest was history. As a person in my personal life, I love to travel. I'm a very creative person, always full of ideas. I'm pretty good at implementing them too, I guess, as a project manager. I'm married to a Sicilian man. We got married last year. So we have a fair few funny word accidents at home as he kind of traverses life in his second language. And it's been super educational for me actually as well to kind of like understand that intersection.
Amazing.
A little bit more too. I've got a sister. I've always been kind of a girl's girl, I would say. I went to an all-girls school. My dad was a bit of a disaster, so I was always closer to my mum and really, really close to my sister. So I guess that kind of, you know, feminism has always kind of been in me from a young age. I suppose in the last 2 years, I would say I've really dialed up my advocacy efforts. I've been in Australia for three. And it was when I first moved here that I decided I think I needed to do a bit more to represent as a person who does not represent the norm in leadership positions as a woman of colour and a migrant. I realised it was there weren't that many people that looked like me.
So I think what attracted you to rail in the first place? Because that's, I mean, I can imagine that that's a reasonably male-dominated industry. How did you... Well, tell me, is it? And how did you end up there?
It absolutely is. I think the stats range from somewhere between kind of 16% to 24% women in rail around the world. I would say like not many women, let's say, go into rail on purpose. Kind of a bit accidental. For me, it was a really attractive graduate scheme with a sponsored master's, a final salary pension and two free Oyster cards that did the trick for me. My family doesn't have a lot of money, so I was really interested in study and kind of further education. And so that was a massive hit for me, was to be able to have someone else pay to further my study. I remember since then, in later in my career, I've been to various talks and things where like perhaps people are speaking to school kids, and honestly they put like pictures of railway signals on like long sections of track with no people in them, and I'm sitting there thinking like, this is not going to send anybody into a career in rail. So I don't think we're very good at that.
I remember years ago now, probably 15 years ago, we were doing some work with the New South Wales government, and we were implementing some services to support their rail network. And I was the project manager, and I had to spend a lot of time with a couple of the people that worked in rail. And they were, I would say, I mean, they were there because they loved trains. And so they took me on train rides. You know, we really got into the network and the, you know, the names of the latest moving stock arriving and all sorts of different things. So there's a deep passion that runs in there.
Certainly is. I didn't know there was a word for it until I came to Australia and I heard the word gunsel, and apparently that is like the name for like a train enthusiast, like a real train lover.
Well, we've all learned something here today. So, well, lucky for us and you kind of did sort of fall into and get attracted into that industry because you've built an incredible career and you were already quite senior in the UK when you were headhunted to come out here. So tell us firstly about that kind of the climb to seniority, I guess, in the UK and then what that looked like coming out here.
Yeah, I've seen loads of kind of presentations and stuff about this kind of like you know, the maze of the career and all the different sideways moves and you know things that you can do, whereas mine was actually really linear. So I went in a completely straight line up the chain from graduate to assistant project manager, senior project manager, program manager, and then eventually director. I had some great sponsors that kind of helped me to do that, gave me opportunities. If I was hungry for more, they would go, all right, then have some more, see how you do. And they would always kind of provide the support that I needed to do well. And then it was the lure of that kind of real game changer role that drew me to Australia. So I was a like a program delivery manager in the UK. So probably like think of it like deputy to the program manager. And the role that I was offered here was a package director. So I was responsible for a big geographical section of the Melbourne Airport Rail project on behalf of the rail operator. And so for me, that was like a catapult to a new height, and it was worth moving hemisphere for. And I gave up a lot to come here. I loved my life in London. I had a great job. I worked for a great company. I literally just met my now husband, so I
Right, I
had
was going to
to.
ask where that came along.
I literally met him 2 weeks after I signed the contract to move to Melbourne. So it was what we would call sod's law in the UK, and we were long distance for 10 months when I first moved here. So we, you know, made a lot of sacrifices to come, but it was worth it to be in a really kind of senior position on an iconic, you know, world-class project. So yes, I'm still sad that it's kind of on hold. That seems to be quite big hold,
So
because it's up.
not everyone will know that story. So maybe briefly just touch on what happened there. And then what did that mean for you?
Yeah, really briefly, it was all sort of full steam ahead. We'd mobilized a big team across the sort of the client, the contractor, the delivery partners. We had enabling works kind of underway and on at the airport and spades in the ground at Sunshine, which was due to be a big interchange station. And then when the treasurer announced the budget, though both the federal and the state governments kind of reconfirmed their commitment, it was put into the 90-day infrastructure review that a lot of kind of projects went into, and it sort of never emerged really. It was a long enough pause that it was tantamount to a cancellation, and basically every single person that worked on the project had to either be redeployed or made redundant across all of the organisations involved. So it was quite a massive ripple effect on the rail industry. For me personally, it meant redundancy. I had a team of probably 15 at the time, and most were redeployed, but a couple of them made redundant as well. It was a really harrowing time, to be honest. It was the first time I had ever experienced redundancy, certainly personally, but also as a leader of a team. And yeah, it's especially sad when I moved 10,000 miles to work on that project for that company.
And
So,
scary, I'm sure scary at the time as well, given you're
yeah.
headed to the other side of the world, literally.
And because I'm still sponsored, so it's a true risk of deportation as well. As a migrant, lots of people don't know this, but if you're still sponsored, you don't have permanent residency yet. You actually only have 60 consecutive days that you can reside in Australia without a sponsor, at which point you basically have to leave and your visa gets
Done.
cut. So it's a really, really scary time. And where we come over with our dependents, that people come over with their children or their husbands or their wives or their partners, you're also responsible for their livelihood and future as well. So if I lose my job and I can't get another one, he has to up sticks and leave too. So it was a really emotionally grueling time. And luckily I'd had itchy feet the year before, and I'd already been offered a job that I'd turned down, just didn't quite feel like the right time, ironically. And so I was able to move pretty fast. But me, normally I would take time to kind of recover from that. I would probably go traveling or take a long break. I can't do that here. I don't actually have the freedom to do that.
And it's such an interesting thing, because I think people probably don't appreciate either that, you know, you've come from somewhere where you had an incredible reputation, really strong network, and you've moved over here. You've obviously still got an incredibly strong reputation, but you don't have the network.
Exactly. I think I remember when I've looked into kind of hiring internationals, and I hired a few in my team, and I do think there's something in that often, you know, people of colour hire people of colour, and women hire women, migrants hire migrants, and I think that's really nice. But I noticed that without kind of local agency, like, and I mean that in the, you know, the purest definition of the word, it's hard for people to choose an international over a local. Now, there's an element of that that's right, isn't there? That, you know, that local jobs first kind of attitude is a really good one. But there's also kind of amazing skills and kind of capability and experience that we miss out on when we kind of, we aren't prepared to take what feels like a risk that isn't really, not really, like, we're all just as likely to do great or do terribly, you know, wherever we come from. So I definitely found that if I was looking for a job in the UK, and I think of who would call me or who would kind of answer my call and go, oh my goodness, come and work here, it was a really different set of companies. I got offered a job by loads of consultancies here, but none of the companies that they would sell me into, none of the client organizations, none of the contractor organizations. And I thought that was really interesting. There'd be a study in that.
Well, you shared something with me that I certainly didn't, not knowing the industry well at all, I didn't appreciate at all, but it was, you're working in a world of engineers and you're not an engineer. So tell us about that, because my understanding from when you and I connected first is there's a big difference between the UK appreciation and Australian appreciation of that. What do we need to catch up on over here?
Oh, so much, I think. I'm hearing that it's starting here, that some of the kind of major contractors, certainly in rail and construction, are starting to look at capability differently and kind of go, like, hold on, we stick engineering degree on every single job ad, like whether you're the comms manager, the commercial manager, the project manager, the engineer, do we really need that? Whereas in the UK, like, when I joined the Transport for London graduate scheme like 17 years ago, I was part of a cohort where none of us in the project management scheme were engineers, because there was an engineering scheme. So if you wanted to go be an engineer, then you joined that one.
Oh, that's true.
Exactly. And it was, so I've worked on, you know, mid-tunnel ventilation shafts, digital media upgrades, the London 2012 Olympics, like demolitions, utilities projects, all kinds of things, because we don't typecast, like, you have to be this type of, you know, engineer and this type of person to come and do this type of thing. Actually, project management is about people, it's about interfaces, it's about problem solving, it's about being organized, it's about leading teams. It's a skills-based profession. And I have always found not being an engineer has been a real kind of, you know, string to my bow, rather than something that makes it harder for me, because I look at problems really differently. And they're all people ones. Like, someone's not doing what you want them to do, there's usually some sort of, you know, a clash of personalities, or like there's team members that don't get on for a certain reason, or like somebody's really having a shitty time and they're not being their best self. But it's usually, it takes all of that empathy and that kind of you know, ability to understand how people tick. That's what makes the best project managers I know the best, is that side of their skills. So I think Australia will get there. I think it's going too slowly, though. I was at a conference last week where one of the companies that's working on this capability framework was saying that they're agonizing about whether they rename the role site engineer, and they don't know what to rename it to. And I'm sitting there being like, just do it. Just whatever, just call it something else. Like, it's not rocket science, and it's not going to change, you know, it's not going to change the world. Just don't sweat over those kind of, it's a small thing, it will make a big difference, but just do it and then move on to the next problem. So
what do you think, Lisa, what do you think gets in the way? Because externally, that seems so obvious. I mean, they're completely different skill sets. You can learn the language of engineer, and actually you're not employed as the engineer on the project. That's what the engineering experts are there for. What do you think holds that back?
I think it's two things. I think one is it's the way we've always done it before.
Yes.
And to be the first to change it is a really scary thing. And you would know that as being a game changer yourself. Like, it's a risk every time you step out and say something that nobody else has said yet, or you look at a problem a different way. And so the fear of something going wrong with a project manager that's not an engineer for the first time you did it, I think is a really scary thing. The second thing is clients. So for lots of these companies where they have to, you know, assign people to clients, or they have to win a contract through a really hefty bid process, they don't want to risk losing the work by having this radical, outlandish team that doesn't look like they're normally do. So I think it's those two things that hold us back. So it's got to be a real systemic change all the way from government down, which is why I think it will take a while.
Let me take a brief pause from listening to the podcast for a minute just to check in and see if the conversation's inspiring any new thoughts or any new reflections for you. I hear so often from people in our audience, largely successful and senior professional women, how much they are craving some inspiration into their lives. I would just love to share with you, if you're looking for some, then come and sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. You can find a link in the show notes at the end of the show. Now let's get back to the podcast. You had some really challenging experiences in the time that you've been here, and I know we won't go into details of them, but what you know, just in broad terms, what is it that occurred in your time here? And I guess, is that connected, and how does that lead into you becoming more vocal and advocating for change?
Yeah, like, absolutely connected. I don't know about you, but I find for myself, as a quite a values-driven person, the most stressed I ever feel, the saddest I ever am, is when I'm not like living up to my own values. Like, if something's happening to me and I'm not dealing with it properly, or I'm not kind of, you know, helping others avoid it, etc., like, I get really, really kind of, you know, troubled about it. I start dreaming about it, I can't sleep, you know. So I had a range of experiences here, and don't get me wrong, I'm not going to do the shit sandwich. I had loads of great ones too.
Yes.
But talking about the not so good ones, I experienced racism here very quickly at work for the first time ever in my career. Now, the UK has a real underbelly of racism, so this isn't a kind of we're doing great and Australia's doing terribly, but yeah. I'd never had it at work before. And it was that manifested as a within the first 6 months I was here, I received an email from a client counterpart who and it was titled "Lisa, your sister?" question mark. And in the body of this email, there was like a looked like a sort of a Combank banner, like an ad, and it had a mixed race woman with Afro hair on it.
No.
And the subject, the body of the email said, "Lisa, is this your sister playing with her phone, or are you starting a trend?" And Melissa, I'd heard this technique called willful ignorance, where you pretend you don't get the joke. And the idea is they're meant to be like, "Oh, hold on, Lisa's a smart person. And if she doesn't get it, oh, wait, no, she does get it." And I've had a real fail. So I wrote back saying, "Oh, I don't understand. What's the trend?" And he wrote back saying, "Your hair."
Oh.
Now, like, just to show you, so my hair is
you've got some glorious hair.
A lot of hair. It's currently industrially restrained by both headphones and hairband. But and it's funny because it's probably the biggest marker. I'm relatively light skinned, definitely brown, but it's the biggest marker, I suppose, on me of difference. And it can often be like a glorious one where people kind of comment on it and tell me they like it, and, you know, it's, that's great. That's really flattering and nice. But it can often just tip over that line to casual racism where it's like, I've become a novelty or a curiosity or an object for you to point at and kind of, you know, make fun of or comment on. And at that point, you realize that you're not being seen as an equal or as a peer, you know, or as a professional person. You're being seen as something to, you know, comment on, you know, the appearance of. So that was kind of the first one. But I had all kinds of things. I had a lot of anti-otherness. I got told once that I didn't have any pedigree, which I believe was talking about my international experience kind of not being worthy here. Like, it doesn't count.
Right.
You haven't done it here, so you have no pedigree.
Yes.
I had a peer who was really, really like a saboteur, kind of very subtle, quite covert attempt to sort of derail my progress or sort of just put some obstacles in the way. And what this did for me is made me think really hard about the subtle things that we experience at work that are often really impactful and are really harpooning our trajectories, our, you know, our ability to reach our potential. Yeah. But we can't do anything about them because each one on its own seems small and insignificant and trivial.
Yes. Yes.
And if you become that person that raises every single one every single time, you're difficult or
you're not getting
sensitive or, you know, all that. So so I thought really long and hard about, like, what do I do about this? So within my own team, I would always be someone that they could come and tell about those things, and we would be wily about how we dealt with them. Like, I wouldn't ever go up to, you did this to so and so and they feel like this. But I would go around the outside and I would kind of make sure they got the credit they needed, or that, you know, the boss knew that that was actually their idea, and, you know, just do things like that. But I created Catching Bees out of my angst for the fact that there was nothing we could do about microaggressions.
Yes.
And I'm so, like, pleased to see how fast it's growing, because we are all out there fed up with the same shit, feeling the same barriers to reporting, to remedial action. And so I'm trying to call it out with a little bit of sarcasm and a bit of humor, and just shine a big old spotlight on those shitty characters, those crappy behaviors, those little things that are really, really affecting our careers.
There was there's a couple that I'll talk to, but there was one that sort of made me laugh, which was the one about jealous manager.
Yeah.
And it made me laugh, number one, because it's absolutely true. If you're working for a jealous manager, it's not likely they're going to catapult your career. But I recently wrote a blog on, and a bit tongue-in-cheek as well, but on, you know, toxic leadership archetypes. And so I did the kind of priority juggler who can never tell you what the actual priorities are. So you're running around doing a million things. And, you know, I'd picked up four kind of archetypes. I missed the jealous manager.
There we go. Well, it's blog number two, isn't it? It's like part two.
Yeah, part two is coming based on your inspiration. So, okay, amazing. But I would love to ask you, because Catching Bees is great, and I encourage everyone to hop on and follow, and they can find it on LinkedIn or on Instagram. And it's just some nice tongue-in-cheek sort of things. But there was another one that I thought maybe we could touch on, which it was a post where you talked about, if you had a pound for every time someone asked you how to support women, like what to do and where to start, you'd have 52 pounds by now. And that really cracked me up. But let me ask you, for people who haven't seen that, or those that, you know, because they'll immediately rush to read the post as soon as they finish the podcast, but let's just touch on what the points were. I mean, your first point about that was get men in the room.
Yeah, I deliver many presentations and talks, and I go to quite a lot of these kind of amazing leadership summits or, you know, diversity and inclusion talks. And most of the time, I'm really disappointed with how few men turn up. Now, sometimes it's kind of the fault of the organisers. You know, they think that on International Women's Day, all the women go to this.
It's engineered that way. Yeah.
It's engineered that way. But actually, a lot of the time, it's not. Now, I've seen it where, so have you ever gone to those conferences where they split the stages? and they'll have like something really technical going on over here, and then
No.
they'll have like the wellness stage or the
Right.
inclusion stage, and then what you see is just a complete crowd split. And I always joke about how we should do social experiments where we go, surprise, we're switching the
This
stages,
talks
and
this
all you,
one.
yeah, that's it, the speaker goes to the technical stage and goes, you're going to listen to
Good
diversity
idea.
inclusion talk today. I think we should really get like that, but that always kind of makes me frustrated, because though there's absolute value in women talking to women or men talking to women about allyship, about diversity and inclusion, usually we're preaching to the converted, and it's validating, but it's not necessarily going to change the world. So we need men in the room to listen, and we have to think, I think, as speakers, around how we frame our message to kind of connect with them and get them to engage. And I often find humor works better than shame,
Yes.
works better than stats, because I think if we put ourselves into the shoes of men, and certainly in industries like construction, if you were being quite conscious of what was going on, you probably would feel a little bit like you're starting to feel like you don't belong, or that you're in trouble for having the role that you have at the expense of whichever women
Yes.
don't have it. And so we do have to, though I'm not like, crying a river about that, I think we do have to kind of have that in our minds. So that was a really big one for me. And I think we just need to do some simple things, like you invite a woman and they invite a man. Or,
Yes.
for every man that comes, invite a woman. For every woman that comes, invite a man. Have KPIs on audience, diversity. Just really push that
That's
mixed
good.
crowd.
I like that. I like that in a world probably driven by KPIs in the corporate spaces we're talking about. That's a good one to do it. Start believing women.
Yeah, it really gets my goat how little we are believed when we raise complaints in the workplace. And I don't know about you, but how often do we hear about women's confidence to speak up?
Oh, all the time.
I
All the
call
time.
bullshit.
Yeah.
We are smart, we are prepared, and we are battle scarred. So rarely do I come across women who don't have the confidence to speak up. We have assessed the danger of a
Yes.
situation and
Yes.
we've gone, can I? If I do, am I going to end up worse than the perpetrator? And
Yes.
then if that is the case, we make different decisions because we have to. So I want to be in a position where when a friend texts me, which happens sadly very often, and says, this thing's happening to me at work, what should I do? I want my absolute default to be, you raise it with your line manager and HR and you make a complaint. Is that my default now? Absolutely not, because so often they're not safe to do that.
Yes,
So
yes.
I think if you see it in the press, you see it in crime in general, like it is a scary thing to see how women's points of view are diminished. Like look at the Spanish World Cup team kiss. It was televised. It was actually
Yes,
televised.
yes.
And look how horrible, grueling a process that had to be, where it was still like under debate of like, oh no, but did he, and was it consensual and all this. It's literally televised and you
Yes.
still don't believe what the woman is saying. So I think we've got a long way to go.
Yeah.
And that has to be that fundamental principle that our voices matter and we don't make this stuff up.
I heard exactly the same thing, and without going into details, I had a beautiful weekend with gorgeous old school friends, and one of them was talking about her daughter who's just started working as a dental assistant and has come across some challenges. And it was exactly the same conversation about. We all wanted to school her to go and talk to the manager, but I think everyone understood what that might mean.
Yeah, we
So,
kind of protect each other informally, don't we? Because we're not protected formally by the system.
yes, that's fascinating. Sweat the small stuff. And this talked about retaining women. And I just love this because I often speak to a lot of CEOs about not only how to attract and promote senior female leaders, but keep them. So
Yeah,
tell
I
us
think
about this.
you know, when that question gets asked me 52 times a year, it's usually like, I just don't know where to start. What could I possibly do? And they're all thinking about what grand action they can take, you know, usually not with budget or resources assigned, mind you.
Very true.
But actually, we get faced every day with a multitude of small moments of diversity or inclusion or retention or attraction, whatever it is. They're always in the small moments. So I see it in like when a senior leader, you know, is meant to go visit a particular team and cancels at the last minute. Fail, small moment. You've just had you've had a fail. You don't know what the impact of that will be, or you know, some one member of your team, you know, mentions something that's happened to them that week, and you're busy, and so you don't give it the appropriate attention, and you go do something else. Small moment that you've just had a fail, and you know, you're in an interview process, and something inside your head says that you know you can't make head nor tail of that CV, and you smell a rat, and so you exclude them from the process. Small moment. So I think for me, it's that everyday action, everyday small behaviors and decisions where we're given multiple chances a day to live those values. And that is what then you and your friends talk about over brunch or whatever. That's how we vouch for certain companies. That's whether, you know, people are having a nice time at work. It's that creates retention. Retention breeds diversity because we tell each other, this is a good place for you. This manager's a good egg. This team is a lovely place to work. People talk, right? Mm-hmm. So I think a simple thing that we gloss over looking for the big ticket items.
And I love that, because it's all of us are in control of those small moments. It's not asking anyone to do massive actions. It's asking each of us to take a bit of accountability to look at how we're acting in those moments and thinking three or four steps down the line. Not just the moment. Number four was recognize and reward potential. You know, women are ambitious, and women of color, I saw the stats even more so. So tell us about that.
Have you ever heard of performance punishment?
Performance punishment. I'm sure I have. You do well, you get loaded up with more, or tell me.
Yes. So, and so often happens to women in the workplace where you're really great. And so they're like, oh, just do this extra project. Or, oh, can you just go help this team? Or can you just work an extra few hours? Oh, but it really needs to be you. It could manifest in, you know, not getting the promotion that you deserve because they really, really want to, you know, to hold you in place, or, you know, unpaid work, kind of, you know, adding on all of those kind of extra hours and then leading you kind of swiftly towards burnout. But it's a simple one where, you know, the theme for International Women's Day this year was invest in women. And we often we're underpaying to start with. We've seen all the gender pay gaps. And then we are failing to reward potential. We are not promoting at the same rate or with the same evidence that we do for men. I've seen a quote before that says, men are promoted on potential and women only on past performance.
Yes.
So we're in that constant sort of never-ending cycle of you don't have the experience, so you can't have the job, but you can't get the experience without getting the job. And so I think a simple thing is we just need to start paying for the work. You know, we see it with speakers.
I would love, if you haven't come across this, I interviewed one of the authors, Professor Laurie Weingart from Carnegie Mellon, is one of the authors of a book called The No Club, Putting a Stop to Women's Dead-End Work. And it goes into this whole subject of non-promotable tasks and how women end up overloaded from a work perspective. It's very linked to what you're talking about there now. I think you will get so much out of it. It's really good. So next one, sponsor things that matter to us.
Yeah, I think we tie ourselves up in knots trying to think of like, oh, what clever idea can I do for diversity and inclusion? Most of the time, passionate people are, you know, out there in your organisation or your industry doing amazing stuff under their own steam with no backing, no sponsorship, no funding. I'm all for just give them money and resources and get out of the way.
Yes.
And that's how change happens, is that you need those people that are super dedicated and really, really passionate about it. And often they're doing it as unpaid work. Make it paid.
Yes.
Go for it. So I think we had, I organised with a friend of mine called Marianne Brennan, we organised Women in Rail drinks, and we had some last week. And for the last two, we've had a sponsor, and it started with a company called FSC who just offered to sponsor it. And I was like, oh, that's amazing. Yes, please. Thank you. And then now we seek one, and it's glorious. All they do is they put a credit card behind the bar. And they ask for nothing else. They don't get to do a speech.
Yep.
They don't get to, you know, stick a load of flyers out. It is literally like doing something that matters to us and putting your money where your mouth is. Doesn't need to be any harder than that.
Invest in women.
Oh, exactly. Just in all of the ways. Like, how many people do you know who self-fund their training? I've got a friend who's
hundreds.
Project manager. Her name's Ashley Oakley. She's awesome, and she is so hungry for knowledge and learning, and so often is not getting sponsored to do that by our organization. So she pays for it herself. Like, I want to see women not have to do that so much. And even often a lot of these government subsidized courses where you can get scholarships, you're still left with like a $7,000 bill, like at the end after the scholarship. Like, you know, who's got that kind of money knocking around when it's not guaranteed to, you know, progress your career to the next level? So I think some really simple things. It's fair pay. It's equal pay for equal work. It's investing in training and development. It's sending us on the course, the trip, the, you know, it's giving us the chance to attend events. It's all of those things.
I love your demonstration there of the small actions and the small moments. Go, Ashley.
Yeah, go, Ashley.
That's amazing. So you got very involved quickly. So Women in Rail and then the National Association of Women in Construction, right? Were they intentional for you building a network? How did they come about?
Yeah, it was actually quite serendipitous. When I was experiencing some of this crappy stuff at work in my first 6 months, I went to Googling and I was like, what do I do? Like, I just need to do more. What can I do? And NAWC, National Association of Women in Construction, just happened to be electing board directors just at that moment. And so I thought, amazing, I'll throw my hat in the ring for that. And I was, you know, fortunate enough to get onto the board. I also signed up to be a professional mentor with the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre.
Mm-hmm.
And probably another 5 or 6 months later, I started catching bees. And so all of those things actually have been really integral in my ability to build a network here. And, you know, also just through work, I'm quite a friendly, happy person. Like, I'm that person that never feels like you can have enough friends. You know, I've got like dotted around everywhere and I'm really good at keeping in touch. So, NAWC has been amazing for the community and the connection, and it's national, so it got me exposed to different states and territories, and I've met kind of unbelievable women and men who were all linked on shared values, which I think always builds a really deep connection, doesn't it? If you connect at that values level. So I'm super grateful for all of the experiences I've had with them and all of the people that I've met. It's an amazing organisation.
Yeah. And you and I also spoke about both of us have had extraordinary male mentors throughout our, and sponsors, importantly, throughout our careers as well. So I think, you know, a big shout out to, I think, anyone who's helped us along the way.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you, from your perspective, why do you think, you know, I often ask people why we don't have more female CEOs. What's your perspective on why there aren't more female CEOs? And even if you just look at your sector, but more broad is fine too.
I think I've got like a range of reasons, I think, some of them darker than others. But there's a phenomenon called the broken rung. So the first step on the career ladder that is broken for women, where, you know, that whole potential versus performance thing means that often we're actually failing to get past middle management. And so we don't have the kind of the pipeline of experience that leads us up to that CEO level. And then when you're sort of close, there's always something you don't have, or you don't have, you know, experience managing a P&L, or you know, you don't have experience at executive level, or you blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, something's always kind of stopping you from getting there. And so there's the less risky, you know, man who they hire instead. There's also something called the glass cliff, which is that there's a societal bias against, you know, giving women that top job unless shit has well and truly hit the fan. And it's almost like, what's the worst that can happen? We may as well give it a go. Yes. In you come. And then we give women like absolute sort of massive challenges and far higher chances of failure. But it's the only way that that kind of, the you know, can be allowed to happen is because they feel like it's a shot to nothing. Like, yeah, what could possibly go wrong? I also think menopause is starting to have a real, is having a real impact and has done for a really long time, where, you know, there's just insufficient attention and, you know, care and conditions in place to support
and understanding
women as they kind of, reach the age that, you know, often men become CEOs, somewhere between 42 and 65, I guess, is where women are experiencing a whole different kind of life, yes, and biological challenge, which is just not cared about or catered for. And there's, I can't remember them off the top of my head, but there's some really alarming stats about the rate of women leaving the workforce at that kind of, you know, perfect CEO age, yes, because of inadequate support for menopause. And then the motherhood penalty is another one, isn't it? Is that women who have children often have to, you know, have no choice but to make sacrifices in their careers, and, you know, the men carry on up the ladder and the women go sideways and part-time, and, you know, there's still not enough allowance for part-time work at the top level, is there? So, and then the darker reasons. In industries like mine, sometimes when I see a parade of CEOs and I see some of the women they let in, and you know, you hear on the grapevine what those women are like, sometimes I think they let the compliant women in. The women who go along with the, like, go with the flow, don't rock the boat, you know, tell them what they want to hear. The darker part of me sometimes just wonders whether it's not changing because those in leadership don't want it to change.
Yeah, and you do talk very much about leaders, you know, leaders do have the power to make those changes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Whenever we hire anybody, we take a risk, don't we? And we accept responsibility, or should, for if that does not work out. That's also our job to deal with. I just think we don't, we think that we're making safe, secure decisions in those top levels, but we're completely failing to appreciate the opportunity cost of, like, what we could be getting, how much better we could be.
Yeah.
But in construction, we build stuff and we make money, and so they go, well, nothing needs to change.
You talk about what I think is an advantage, and perhaps people don't necessarily realise, but you use the term hypervisibility.
Yeah. I once went to a Black History Month talk by an amazing man called Frank Douglas, and he, a Black man, and he said that hypervisibility works both ways. And I just thought it was such a nugget, and I've never forgotten it. And it manifests in so many ways that we take for granted. And me and Div Pillay, who I think you've interviewed,
yes,
before, we're having a good old chat about how no one ever forgets my name. Everyone remembers that they've met me, you know, because I look completely different to most of the other people that they met that day. So where we often beat ourselves up about, did we say a stupid thing, or what if we screw this up, or imposter syndrome, or whatever. The other way of looking at it is when we say a smart thing, everyone remembers,
yes,
that it was us. When we nail that job, everyone knows that it was you. You know, when someone talks about you in a room when you're not there, everyone's like, oh, I know Lisa, I know,
yes,
Melissa. You know, it's, and that is a glorious thing, and it's an absolute superpower that we should be proud of and take advantage of, for sure. So it's like, on the other hand, sometimes if I meet like another white, bald, middle-aged man, and they're like, oh, hi, Lisa. I'm like, shit. Like,
what's your name?
What's your name? Where did I meet you? Because, you know, I must sit in a meeting with 20 of those,
yes,
every day.
Yes.
Now, don't get me wrong, though. Obviously, I'm being facetious. But it's a thing we should look at. Div told me about, she went to an event and she wore a sari, and she absolutely, like, you know, smashed it.
Nailed
everybody
it.
Was like, oh, my God, you look fabulous. And everyone would have remembered div in Asari at that event, you know, like, oh, I just think we should proudly, you know, take our differences.
Claim it, take our space and own it. I think that's absolutely amazing. Now, you and your gorgeous new husband, congratulations, are leaving our shores.
We certainly are. It's actually like heard it here first, like exclusive. I haven't really told the internet yet. But yes, we are, we're literally about to pack up everything. There's nothing in my house. I don't even need the blur on because there is nothing in here. There's literally all of our furniture is gone. So we literally have our stuff picked up for shipping on Thursday and we're heading back to the grey skies of London.
Wow, fantastic. Well, good timing. You'll be heading into summer-ish as you head there anyway. A little bit of travel on the way?
Yeah, always. I'm always that person that takes a break between jobs, always. I don't know why more people don't do that. I think we think that everything has to be so urgent, but they picked you. They'll wait for you.
Yes. Oh, that's such good advice for people to hear that. So the final question, Lisa, and it's just been an absolute joy. I am so glad we met. I'm so glad I saw that 52-pound post and it kind of tickled my sense of humour as well. I thought that was so good. From your perspective, what does brave feminine leadership mean? And do you think it needs to change?
I think it means being able to be your complete self with all of the, you know, the vulnerabilities or your ability to, you know, as Barbie would say, hold both emotion and logic at the same time. And I think that it's for us to blaze the trail for being, you know, kind, you know, vulnerable and brilliant leaders who are not conforming to the way that it's always been done before, if that's not your natural personality. I think that's the brave part. It can be really hard to do that, can't it? It can feel like we have to be like everyone else, talk like everyone else, behave like everybody else. And I think that that's the saddest thing that we can possibly do. I think that there are some things that need to change. I think there are still too many stories of women who don't support other women who have reached leadership roles. And I know that that's a topic of much contention amongst my Catching Bees followers. And I do try to do some posts about the not so good women who've made it up there. So the bit I want to see change is that those women stop pulling up the ladder because they had to suffer. You know, we've all got a responsibility to pay it forward and model what good looks like, make space for everybody else.
And use our voices.
Absolutely.
Yeah, fantastic. Lisa, brilliant to have had this conversation. I know I will be following along Catching Bees for your continued kind of observation and humour about all of these things that really touch everyone and do get in the way of people's careers. There's no doubt about it. So thank you so much for agreeing to join our conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for having me. Me too.
And that was the end of another podcast conversation. So thank you so much for listening to the episode today. I often hear from leaders who felt inspired by the conversations and are ready to put themselves first. And so I wanted to take a brief moment just to share how I've helped hundreds of women, just like you, become crystal clear on the exact steps they should be following right now to lead an intentional and sustainable life without second guessing themselves so that they can maximize their influence and impact. I've put some details into the show notes and there's a link there where you can find out some more about our signature Elevate and Influence program. While you're there, take the time to sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. Have a brilliant day.